Freedom Fiends. Broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus, Aurelius, by pointing our beams into your brain. I'm Michael Dean. How you doing, Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker?
Hey, I'm doing good. I'm doing well, and I'm doing well.
Yeah. Man, holidays. They make a lot of people happy. They don't make me happy.
They wear me down.
They wear me down because, you know, I've said before that, I mean, I like the idea of families getting together and, you know, celebrating things they believe in and having fun, but it often just turns out to like expectations. So I've kind of like given up on that. Like my wife and I just kind of, you know, we send some cards, we send, some money. then we just stay home and eat a bunch of food and don't do a whole lot other than that. But, and you're a Quaker, you don't celebrate days as special over other days. And why is that?
You know, I really just don't buy into the idea that one day is any more magical than the next. And, you know, if somebody else does, that's great. And if they want to enjoy, you know, rituals and all these things that we do, then that's fine. It doesn't offend me or bother me. I'm not going to demand anybody not do that. And I'll even go to the functions and, you know, but I don't, deep inside me, I really don't recognize one day as being any different than any others. Most, you know, as you well know, Michael, most holidays are just arbitrarily made up for some weird reason or carried over from some ancient pagan date that really, you know, was based on the angle of the sun or some silly thing.
Wasn't Jesus born like in July in the third year AD of what we call it or something like that?
Yeah, it was probably somewhere late summer, early August, or early autumn, sometime in that time frame, because it was about the time they were doing the census, which would have been late in the year, or you know, possibly around harvest time, because that's when you would determine what somebody had. Because the census was about taxation, so you want to tax people after they gather their harvest. So yeah, he was born sometime late summer, early fall, something like that.
Yeah.
That's okay. You know, if people want to cut a tree down and drag it in their house and get, you know, pine needles all over their, you know, their carpet, and if that makes them feel good, then it doesn't bother me. It's, you know, that's fine, whatever.
Yeah. I had some things happen around the holidays when I was a kid that made me really not like them. And I don't want to go into that, but basically if anybody expects me, you must celebrate and be happy, I'm like, yeah, have a good time. I'm going to go shut my door with you on the other side of it.
Well, I think you and I have this streak of independence that says, you know, I don't want to serve any, I don't want to serve a special magic day. I don't want to serve a government. I don't want to serve, you know, a boss. I want to do what I have to do to survive and to support my family, but I don't want to be a servant to somebody else. I spent, you know, way too much time living that life, and now I want to be free of it.
Yeah, and I feel like being societally expected to, you know, feel thankful on Thanksgiving and religious on Christmas and, you know, loving on Valentine's Day and redemptive on Easter. I feel like it's collectivist, and I feel like it's kind of socialist in a way, and it just kind of reminds me of football. And I like sports. I just don't like the groupthink that goes along with sports. I also don't like the way fans of sports say "we" about their team while they're like, you know, people that would have a heart attack if they ran one end of a football field to the other, you know, sitting there eating chips and drinking beer and saying "we won" and being like patriotic and nationalistic about their town and their team. And you know, when the guys on that team like wouldn't give them the time of day and probably resent that they ever have to actually go out and shake hands with any of them.
Yeah, you know, I hate to say it, spending the last 20 years or so living in Ohio, you get hyper nationalism about Ohio State University.
Well, Ohio has nothing else, so all they can do is be proud. That's paraphrasing what a friend of mine, this girl I dated who was from Ireland, I was like, why do the Irish have so, and I'm, you know, Irish American, but I was like, why do, you know, your people, why do people in your country have so much pride? And she said, because we have nothing, and pride is easy to have when you have nothing, which is, you know, I mean, there's a I'll say this, the Irish fought harder for their independence than a lot of people. They didn't get it. They stick to their guns, and I'm not saying anything, you know, in favor of violence, but they weren't as easily cowed. Some of them weren't as easily cowed to, okay, we'll go be good Englishmen now, you know.
Yeah, I think that is the case with Ohio, because it has, football-wise, you know, it has the Cincinnati Bengals, which are always a disappointment, and the Ohio Browns, which are almost always a disappointment. And so to have Ohio State University with a decent football team, it gives people who have no hope of ever attending a college or a university, you know, barely got out of high school, if that, it gives them this weird Ohio nationalism that they can put up Ohio State University stuff all over their car and make it seem like they're part of the team when they're not. I mean, you know, they're just not. It's an illusion.
Yeah, I guess it's people kind of go into sheep mode around holidays in a way that kind of makes me fearful, you know, like to even, I mean, people are driving crazy. They may have been drinking a little bit, but even if they're not, they're like, I must get to the mall. I must get to the party. I must get home and wrap presents. I must, you know, and it kind of seems like nobody really wants to do it. It kind of seems like they're expected. I'm sure there are people who want to do it. And I know there are people who get satisfaction out of giving. And I guess there's also something kind of like socialist to me about the idea of expecting presents from people on a certain day.
Yeah, I think I really think all the holidays are kind of like a socialist thing where you say, you know, today we feel patriotic. Today we feel religious. Today we love our spouse. Today we, you know, celebrate dead. I don't know. What is Halloween? Death? It's a celebration of death.
It's a pagan holiday that's restructured as a pagan holiday, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it does kind of have a collectivist thing. Like, you know, every other day, what are we supposed to not love our spouse every day? Well, that's not Thanksgiving. I mean,
that song by Dead Kennedys called Halloween. You know, it says, you're dressed up like a clown. Remember what I did. Remember what I was back on Halloween. Why not every day? Are you so afraid? What will people say? Why not every day? You know, like, why not have every day be Halloween? Which was kind of the punk rock thing, you know? It was like, I'm going to dress up weird and paint my hair and my face every day. And, you know, we got bottles thrown at us people that, you know, I would probably want to go shooting with now, but, you know, people would like drive by in pickup trucks and throw bottles at us and yell Devo, you know, not knowing that Devo wasn't really punk rock, but it was the only thing that they'd seen on TV that remotely looked like our hairstyles maybe somehow. So
I think that's kind of why I like the time frame between Christmas and New Year's, because it's kind of like it's kind of like the whole,
like, now
society. Yeah. It's kind of like the whole society is sort of holiday hungover, and they're waiting for that last, you know, they're waiting to wake up and have that really stiff drink that gets them over the hangover in the morning and then go about their life again.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like that, you know, in the party world, that 5 o'clock in the morning feeling where before everybody else has woke up, hungover and sick, and all the hardcore drunks are asleep, and you're sitting there in a nice quiet house, and you're the only one sober and the only one awake. And that's really a kind of an interesting time frame.
I can see that. Yeah. I really hate the time from, like, pretty much the whole last 3 weeks of December and, you know, part of the first week of January, because everything that I do involves interfacing with other people and trusting that they are, you know, coherent and available. And, you know, I mail a lot of things. I FedEx a lot of things. FedEx goes on the holidays, but it's more money. You know, I go to the bank. There's a lot of things I do, you know, to make my art and make my money. That in basically the world shuts down for those 3.5 weeks, and I don't want to. And, you know, I do a show every day, and I can't. It's hard to get people to do everything that they just kind of leave their post. They abandon the world abandons its post. That's how I feel.
We're the only ones left on the wall, Michael.
Well, we are, and that brings me to today's topic and title, show title. The name of this show today on the Freedom Fiends is Do Everything as If It's the Only Thing You'll Be Remembered For.
You know, I have a real quick story about a fence. I think I can fit this in before a break. When I was about, I'm going to just make a wild guess and say 21 or 22, a guy contracted me to build a brick fence, a brick wall. Actually, it was a fence. There's a difference between a wall and fence. A brick fence around the front of his house, a nice decorative, short, but nice decorative brick fence. And I had some skill with masonry that my dad had taught me. So I spent a couple of hard, I was working full time at the time at a chemical factory. So I spent a couple hard days off really, you know, putting effort into making this guy's fence really look good, straight, level, plumb, all the stuff that really, it takes some effort and some skill when you drive by a brickwork to be able to look at it and recognize straight lines and that it's plumb and that it's level and all those magical things that make brick look good. And so I put a lot of effort into this brick fence. And years later, I lived in that town for about 12 years. And years later, even after, when I built the fence, I didn't have any kids yet. It was my wife and I had just got married and we didn't have any kids. And years later, I could drive by that neighborhood with my kids and point to that fence and say, see that fence? I built that. I did that. And look at it. Look how straight it is. And there was there's time. People say that pride is a bad thing, or people take pride on stuff that they have no involvement in the accomplishment, like a team winning a game. But when you do something that is really you, and you've put your efforts and your blood and your sweat into it, and then you can step back and look at it, and you know that thing in all likelihood will be there long after I'm gone. That really touches something eternal inside a person.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad, I mean, as simple as like, there's some trees that my dad planted in the 60s, you know, some pine trees that he planted from saplings with a tractor and planted 100 acres of them with my mother. And, you know, they're giant trees now. Like he was selling Christmas trees for a while, but when I was a kid, but they're too big for Christmas trees now. So even that, man, plant a tree. And a whole mess of trees. We'll be back after this trip to the free market. The freedom of the ends.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Now that the elections are over and liberty has slipped even further away, it's time to try yet another political organization. Campaign for a Longer Leash is a nonpartisan group of pups and dogs dedicated to fighting for longer leashes for all. We're not talking about no leashes, that would be catarchy. We just want the limited leash that the Hounding Fathers promised us. As Bone Barklin once said, a longer leash if you can keep it, ma'am. For more info, go to facebook.com/campaignforalongerleash.
Stone the Bad Quaker from badquaker.com. Ben doesn't know this because he can't hear it, but I put a tiny bit of reverb on his voice. Tiny, tiny bit. So he sounds like he's in a church giving a sermon.
Echo, 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 echo. So do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for. I think that's that's a powerful statement.
Yeah, that's the, I said that in my book, $30 Film School, that came out in about, 2001, something like that, 2002. I don't even remember. I'm not one of these people that rests on my laurels. That's like 100 projects ago, 100 major projects ago, or, you know, probably 40 major projects ago. But, you know, if you consider like a project, you know, a feature length album where I play everything on it and wrote all the music and sang it and produced it, or, you know, a radio show like the Freedom Fiends, which is on episode 560 or something. I don't even know. I don't even count. I only count when I'm numbering them and uploading the archives. But yeah, man, do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for. I mean, that's, you know, other than with doing art or any kind of literature or science, you know, inventing something or computer programming or anything that where you use, you know, your higher brain functions and your creativity and your imagination to make something that is useful to people that they want to buy or sell or trade or, you know, tell other people, tell two friends about. Really, like, the only advice I have, I mean, I have lots of advice on technical things about how to get better audio from things and, you know, how to do the like technical basics that don't involve any creativity. Once you learn that, the rest of it is just innovation and practice and, you know, not giving up. And other than learn the basics of your craft, you know, if you're a painter, learn about colors, learn how to draw, you know, a figure, and what, how to mix paint and how to clean up paint and how to stretch canvas if you're stretching it and just the basics of it. Other than that, it's just a lifetime of improving. You're never really done any particular painting or song or podcast or radio episode isn't the thing. It's just one point on a line that stretches to the end of your life and beyond. And if you do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for, you'll make the best stuff you can do. I mean, that's the only advice I have. Two pieces of advice for people that want to change the world. You know, one is learn the basics of your craft, the technical aspects of it. And the other is just do it as if it's the only thing it's going to be remembered for, because that happens a lot. You know, I mean, there's a lot of painters that are known for one painting. There's a lot of writers that are known for one book. There's a lot of, you know, singers that are known for one song. You never know what video you put on YouTube is going to go viral or why. So make it all great, man. Don't skimp and say, oh, this is just for, you know, this. No one's going to see this.
You know, I might add to my brick wall story there. The reason I got that job is because somebody saw the work that I was doing with brick inside the chemical plant that I worked in. I was bricking the inside of an oven that's a big rotary oven. It's like about as big around as a school bus. And I was inside there doing the brickwork. And once we completed the brickwork, we had to coat all of the brickwork in this sort of this material that would harden and sort of form like a ceramic inside it. So once we got done, the brickwork would be hid forever until they tore the thing down. And he was noticing how careful I was to make sure all my lines were straight and everything was perfect. And he asked me, "What, you know, why do you do that? You're going to cover it all with coating. When you're done, nobody will ever see it." And I told him, and it just popped out. I didn't even think about this answer. I said to him, "Somebody is going to tear this down at some point. When this brickwork gets old and has to be replaced, somebody's going to tear it down. And when they do, they're going to see my work. And I don't want to be embarrassed about that."
And they won't even know your name and you won't be around. But yeah. I mean, I've seen like, you know, repairmen or mechanics with cars, like taking something apart and being like, man, when they're in it and it's taken apart, they're like, man, they don't make them like this anymore. And I've seen people like demolishing a house to build a new house. And like, man, these old houses are hard to demolish because they don't make them like they used to. And, yeah, man, take pride in what you do, but, don't live in pride. Right. That's another thing too, man. Be a, you know, it sounds communist to say be a worker among workers. I'm not saying like be a bee in the hive, but it's more like know that you're a small but important part of the universe and try to make things so great that your little part will stand out and make the whole thing better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not so you didn't know what I said. Knees look on hips and knees and then you're here.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Do you believe in free speech? Jay Raven had her True Shives YouTube channel taken down. We believe this censorship was wrong, and we believe the channel is a clear example of free speech. Many people are bullied on the internet, but Jay Raven actually stood up to the bullying. She has filed a self-defense lawsuit against the individuals who took down the channel. The outcome of this suit could be very important to the future of free speech. Learn more at trueshibes.com. That's Tango, Romeo, Uniform, Sierra, Hotel, India, Bravo, Echo, Sierra.com. Trueshibes.com.
Freedom Fiends. So Ben Stone and I are talking about the concept of do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for. So we better live up to that and do a good show today. We better let's do this show as if we know we're going to die tomorrow.
You know, I kind of did that at Porkfest back in, what was it, 2012? 2012. I went into Porkfest with this weird thought that for some reason I thought this was going to be it. I didn't know why I felt that way, but I thought this will be the last time I'm at Porkfest. This will be the last time I speak publicly. And I didn't know why I thought that, but then months later, I ended up sitting in a hospital in Mobile, Alabama, on the edge of death, thinking, wow, it was a good thing I put some effort into that talk that I did at Porkfest. But yeah. Then, you know, I greased myself all up and slipped out of death's fingers and ran off laughing.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're doing a lot of Freedom Fiends, too, because they get heard by more people than you just do in your podcast. And we have things in place we have people keeping them and torrenting them forever. And you can go to the Freedom Fiends site and click on the Torrent Club link over on the right side if you want to help keep us drone-proof for the next 100 years.
We have top men working on it, and you can be one of those top men.
Top men.
And women.
And women, yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to Porkfest this year, probably.
I probably won't be either. It's a very expensive trip. And
it really is. I mean, last year, like, you know, we both cyber-begged a bit to get some of the money, but, well, you more than me. I cyber-begged on your behalf, but... I mean, literally, like, we could afford it if we want, but, you know, we're getting a little older than most people who go to Porkfest. We don't want to really sleep on the ground. We want to get in a hotel, which also means getting a, you know, rental car. I mean, the whole thing round trip for us is like $2,500, and it's kind of like we could do that, or, you know, we could go see some relatives that are getting kind of up in years that, you know, who knows how long they'll be around. I'm not saying I'm not going to Porkfest again. We're going to go again at some point, just probably not this year. We're going to think about it for a few more weeks and probably decide by like January 15th for sure. But yeah, man.
You know, going with our topic of do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for. And then you were talking about seeing people that, you know, might not be around forever. And I was thinking about the first time my wife and I met in California. Both she and I were both born in California. We got married in California. And eventually we made our way back to Eastern Kentucky, where all of my family has been for, you know, a couple hundred years. And as we drove into the area that my family has predominantly lived in during that time in Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia, I started, and I didn't even realize I was doing it. I was just, you know, kind of the travel guide as we were going in. And I was like, there's a house right over there as we turn a corner. Okay, that house, my grandfather built that house. And then we come around another corner, and I'm, you know, and like, my dad built that. He used to run a shop there. He had a gas station and an auto repair shop there. And then we round another corner, and I'd say, there used to be a house there that my grandfather built, but then my second cousin burned it down for insurance purposes, you know. And then we'd round another corner, and I'd point out a house. My grandfather built that house. And it got to be a joke as we drove the like 30 or 35 miles into Appalachia, where we were headed to the family reunion that we were going to. It became a running joke of how many houses that my cousins had burned down and how many that my grandfather had built. And yet, even with that running joke, there was something very real in the fact that that my grandfather had done these things. And he's been dead since like the 1980s, since the late 1980s. And yet his legacy lives on, not only in grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren. That's fine, too. And some people, you know, some people have the luxury of having that, and some people don't. But there's a physical thing driving down the road and looking at houses that are still standing that my grandfather built. And knowing that each one of those, he took pride in, not only that other people would see it or, you know, oh, this is a nice looking house or whatever. He was answering to himself in doing that, that he knew he was doing a good job. And because of that, they still stand.
Yeah. I think that a lot of the reason things get made other than necessity, I think part of the reason they get made well, other than, you know, feeding your family back when people were actually paid for the quality of their labor and not some kind of like socialist math by the government. I think a lot of it's got to do with fear of death, or not necessarily fear of death, but realization and maybe even resigning yourself to, or like embracing the fact that, you know, your human body will not be on this earth in this form forever. And it really, once you hit the age of 50, it really starts to, you really start, I mean, like, you know, you think, well, I should write up a will, and you write up a will, and, you know, you make plans for what will happen in the event of your sudden death, even though, you know, I mean, my dad's 93, you know, and he's still, he's not as sharp as he used to be, but up until about age 90, I mean, he was still working, you know, he was still working part-time selling real estate and running a few companies, the few that his, you know, ex-wife, not my mother, you know, hadn't stolen from him. She married, my dad left, was seduced away from my mother after 36 years of marriage. And, then, you know, married some other woman who treated him horribly, and then like took 5 houses that he owned that he'd like worked his whole life to like build up all this capital. And, then, you know, divorced him, willed all his stuff to her grandkids and great grandkids. And then she died, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's heartbreaking.
It really is, man. And, yeah, I would never do that.
But, you know, part of it too, though, is just answering to yourself on a day-to-day basis. I think that's a large reason why we do the Freedom Fiends. The way that we do it, we don't do like so many other talk shows do, and so many libertarian podcasts do, and so much, there's so much out there that's just grabbing headlines. And
Barack Obama, you know, is a liar. He's a socialist. And his feet stink. I like to say that once an hour, and I'm quoting my 93-year-old dad when I say that. But that's all I'm going to say about politics for this show.
Yeah, because really, we're in this not just to echo what the mainstream media is saying, or even, you know, complain about what the mainstream media is saying, and just constantly rehash what we're fed. And that's not what we're about. We're really more about making a statement that 10 years from now or 100 years from now, somebody can bump into it and go, you know, these guys had something to say, and look at the time frame when they were saying it. Nobody else was saying that at the time.
And I'm not, yeah, and when we say that, we're not necessarily saying, like, we will be great men remembered for the ages. It's more like, I want to make stuff that's as good and universal that it could be listened to like that, rather than have to be studied as the events of the day. Like, you know, I want things to be able to be consumed in 100 years the way that a good old novel can be consumed, in a way that's far more enjoyable and resonates deeply in your heart than a newspaper from 100 years ago. I mean, a newspaper from 100 years ago is kind of interesting from a historical standpoint, you know, if you take into account the fact that in most newspapers, the only thing that's true is the headline. I mean, the date, not even the headline. But, and, you know, from 100 years ago, what was going on in the newspaper? The Lusitania was sunk. No, that was a false flag, man. So there.
You know, I was, this is taking this in a maybe different direction, but I was looking at some old Bob Hope stuff not long ago. And I remember when I was a kid, I really enjoyed Bob Hope's form of humor. He was really funny for me. And I'm looking at it now and I'm thinking, you know, my kids would not get any of this stuff because it was so time sensitive. Everything that he was talking about related to the headlines and the time frame that he was talking in. And as wonderfully humorous as it was in 1965 or 1975, it means almost nothing nowadays.
Whereas, like, there was comedy from a long time ago, like Fibber McGee and Molly, or, you know, Who's On First, which is kind of square and quaint compared to now, but it's still funny because it really doesn't reference a lot of, you know, breaking news from the day.
Yeah, I think that's why the Three Stooges have lived, you know, why they continue to be funny, because forever.
I never thought slapstick was funny, but go on.
Well, there's this element within the human that likes, you know, the football to the crotch or the pie to the face.
I never. It just seems mean, man. I don't like mean. I really don't.
To a certain extent, though, that's kind of why, going in the opposite direction, the Marx Brothers were always the flip coin.
They were funny.
Yeah. And yet they weren't entirely dependent upon the time frame either. They were, you know, there was satire, there was irrelevance, there was all the stuff that it took to get the comedy there without the headline and without slapping each other in the side of the head or pulling each other's hair out.
And they also had pod beef. You know, which is what we talk about, like when you're on a podcast or a radio and you're beefing with somebody else, you know, in your realm that not necessarily the audience knows about. They have a movie that takes place in a ridiculous town called Fredonia. Fredonia is Fredonia, New York, is one town over from Westfield, New York, where I grew up. We used to go shopping in Fredonia. They got booed off the stage doing live comedy in Fredonia, so they made it the brunt of a whole movie. Pod beef.
And they kind of made it sort of Nazi-esque or Hitler-esque, yeah, in their
yeah. Yep. And you know, going back to like the thing of dad driving, you know, your relatives driving you around the county and showing you like what used to be from the old days, I gotta say, like, a lot of that really bored me, because you know, I love my family, and I love, like, they grew up on a farm, and they moved to a town away from the farm, like, the year I was born. So I didn't have the close upbringing that my three siblings and my mother and dad had. And, like, you know, my siblings were going off to college when I was, you know, born. And, you know, my parents got divorced when I was 8, and my parents were both, you know, I was a latchkey kid. I was kind of raising myself with the TV, watching Adam 12 and stuff, and eating chicken pot pies from the freezer. But and I liked it. I just go to the library and hang out and learn. But it kind of, like, it kind of bored me. And I think, looking back at it now, it's like, you know, my dad was telling me about, like, the first post office in our county that your grandfather was the postmaster at. And I was like, in my head, I was trying to, like, invent podcasting and Fiend Phone, and, like, you know, those things didn't exist yet. I mean, I was trying to, like, reach the world with ideas in a way that was faster than books. That's why I embraced the internet when I got on it in 1991. All right, man. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach, and donate most of our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to the Freedom Fiends on the radio worms.
All right, so Ben Stone and I are talking about doing everything you do as if it's the last thing, the only thing you'll be remembered for.
You know, I've got a flip side of this story, too. George Armstrong Custer. Here's a guy, I don't particularly like him, you know, in history and so forth. He was a thug and a tyrant, just like
General
all the rest.
Custer?
Yeah, yeah. The dead dude.
One of
but,
them.
But during the, you know, during Lincoln's War of Aggression, or the Civil War, as the historians like to call it, Custer was, like, when he went to West Point, he excelled. He was amazing. He was brilliant. He was the youngest kid at West Point at the time. He went through, graduated either at the top or real close to the top. I can't remember which now. Came out of West Point. He was just a ball of fire. Every assignment he was given, he was right on top of it. He was like, you know, if you want... The old thing, let's give 110%. Well, that's ridiculous. You can only give 100% by its very nature of the, you know, of the maths involved. But Custer was the kind of a guy that always shot for a higher place than he could possibly obtain. And by doing that, he obtained a higher place than anybody else was. And he did so to the point of where he became a serious political threat to the powers that be in Washington, D.C., being William Tecumseh Sherman and U.S. Grant and Sheridan and all the guys who controlled government at the time, or controlled the face of government at the time. Custer became a real serious political threat to them. So they demoted him. They sent him out west. They tried to get rid of him. They assigned him to minor posts and did everything they could to try to take him off the public's eye. And yet, he was still doing magnificent things right up to his final act that he did, which was an unbelievable act of arrogance and stupidity, and he died. And so for the rest of forever, it's going to be forgotten what a magnificent commander in military that he was, as disgusting as that may be. And he'll always be remembered as this arrogant idiot who didn't listen to his advisors and took a small, a poorly armed group of men into a massive,
death.
And just got butchered while he had at his reserve, just a short ride away, enough supplies and enough men and enough equipment to have won the battle. And yet, because he ran ahead and just swam in arrogance and made a stupid decision, that's what he's remembered for. So I think there's a balance there between, wisdom and exuberance and the ability to really accomplish some amazing things. But looking at yourself, knowing your enemy, knowing what your opponents are thinking, and really knowing who your enemy is. Because in Custer's situation, he recognized, the Native Americans as his enemies, but he didn't realize he had much bigger enemies in Washington, D.C. that were much more of a threat to him.
Isn't that always the case?
Yeah, Washington, D.C. is always a bigger threat to us than we recognize. Do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for. And that's what he's remembered for.
Yeah, and I want to reiterate a little bit of something we said before and set up for the second hour here about talking about the government. Is it's important to do once in a while about how tyrannical things are and pointing out the fact that you can't fix stupid, you can't fix government. It's an immoral system based on theft, fraud, coercion, and aggression. You should work towards voluntary systems. Well, if you don't want to be, if you don't want to be a sinner, if you don't want to be a violent thug by proxy, I recommend that you consider working, barter as much as you can, work with your neighbors as much as you can, work outside of the system, don't take the government job, work in the private sector, even if it pays less. Just try to build your own things with people you care about and try to live as free as you can. And a lot of that has to do with your priorities and what goes on in your mind. You've heard that thing of political prisoners who say they can lock up my body, but they can't, they can't lock up my mind. That's really true, man. And in hour two, Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, and I are going to talk a bit more about living as free as you can, organizing your life in such a way that you're not beholden to others, regardless of whether they fine you for not getting the health insurance that isn't very good health insurance. And no matter what they do, man, there were people that lived under tyrants that lived freer than a lot of Americans because of their mindset. And I'm talking real tyrants. We'll be back for hour two after this trip to the market. Worms.
Worms.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com. Yeah, this is the Freedom Fiends broadcasting through the Libertarian Reindoctrination Center's low orbit ion cannon. High atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite, LibPair 2017, in the Alpha Centauri region. I'm either there or I'm in Airworm 1, the blimp that I fly over Recluse, Wyoming in and really enjoy it. So Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker from badquaker.com, are you there?
I am here.
Excellent. And the topic today is do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for. And you were talking in the show we did a while back, kind of recently, about a week or two ago. The topic was lying. I think it was last weekend. The topic was lying and truth.
Yeah.
And we went off on this cool tangent where you talked about people.
About selecting who you spend your time with. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, I made a misstatement in the last hour, and I can kind of bring these two things together. I said when I was at Porkfest in 2012 that I had a feeling that it was my last time I was speaking in public, and I was actually mistaken on that. That event took place in 2013. In 2012, my wife and I lost one member after the other of our close family.
Yeah.
We started out, we lost my wife's mother, my mother-in-law. And then out of nowhere, that was unexpected, and it hit us hard because my mother-in-law was not that old. And then out of nowhere, we lost my son-in-law, my daughter Kai, her husband. And again, you know, that was right out of the blue. He was not old at all.
Yeah, I'm glad you explained this because, you know, otherwise it just sounds like, oh, you're 50-something and you're worried about death. That's silly. But it's like, you know, you had a bunch of family members who were 50-something, you know,
yeah,
died or less. Suddenly. Yeah,
yeah,
in that time.
In that same time frame, my wife's nephew, who we had just had dinner with and just talked to, and he was a real nice kid. And bam, he's dead. And he was in his early 20s, you know. And then the guy I was named after, my uncle, my namesake, died. And that wasn't a shock because he was very, very old and he was in ill health. But he was a really unique individual. He had spent his life making a living the way he chose. So, like, he wandered in Appalachia gathering ginseng. And that was before it was popular and a TV show made about it and stuff like that.
Before it was illegal to do it without a permit.
Yeah. And he had just spent, he was a gambler and he had a really fantastic life. And that's who I was named after. And then later on, you know, my dad died in that same year. And then going into, and by the end of 2012, my wife, who had been, who had a very good career and was very well established in the corporation that she was in a technical support area, she realized that she was spending her whole life inside a corporation, inside a cubicle, serving other people and not doing the things that she wanted to do with her life. And so, you know, literally at the end of 2012, we just dumped everything and paid cash for a new motorhome and hit the road and got away from it. And that was the setup to that feeling in 2013 when I was at Porkfest. But we learned so much over the next year that it's critical to be able to control who's around you, that who influences you, who you have to deal with on a daily basis, and remove from you know, for our situation, remove all those leeches that were sucking the life away from us and live a life that, and we made sacrifices to do that. You know, our income dropped by about 70% within that time frame. And we had to really buckle down and really re-examine, is it important that we stop at this fast food place or can we just stop at a grocery store and, you know, buy this and this and this and make it ourselves? And, you know, we really came to a grasp with who is important in our life. What activities are we doing that are important and what are we doing that's just going through the motions and that's just keeping the boat floating? And I think that's a level of wisdom that, you know, I wish I had that when I was 20. My whole life would have been different. But I've come into more wisdom just since 2012 because of those events. And that's what you have to do when something bad happens. You either have to let it grind at you and beat you down, or you have to look at it and say, all right, you know, how am I going to take this? How am I going to take all these rocks that have fallen on my head and build a wall out of them and build something good out of it and build something that's going to stand? And I think one of the major things in our life that helped us during that time was getting away from all the leeches and all the mosquitoes and all the down stuff that was dragging us down and killing our time and sucking away our lives, and start spending time together and really get to, and we already knew each other. My wife and I have been married 2015. So we're coming up on 35 years that we've been married. So we've already, you know, we're past that stage of getting to know each other. And yet we got to know each other on a depth in the last 2 years that a depth of comfortableness to where we can be together and we can do stuff. And talking is nice. We still talk, but it's not an absolute necessity. We don't have to fill the voids. We don't have those awkward moments where we have to figure out something to say to keep the conversation rolling. It's just not necessary anymore. And we've removed all the people, and this is not isolationism, and we're not, you know, we're not defooing a bunch of people in our lives. We still have all the people who love us. Even if we don't agree with them, they're still a part of our family. They're still a part of our life. But we have separated ourselves from the ones who just drag us down, or the ones who are constantly needing something from us, or the ones who are constantly making bad decisions that we have to go and advise and help and bail out. And we've gotten away from that stuff. And now, you know, we can watch sunrises, and we can, you know, the big event is walking the dog next to a swamp while keeping an eye out for an alligator to make sure an alligator doesn't jump out and swallow the dog.
Yeah. I think that, the key to a mate that you want to be with is, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's important when you first meet somebody, but as you get older, what's really important is, do you want to spend time in a room with them? And, you know, I've heard this saying that life is a series of rooms, and the quality of your life depends on the decisions you make that put you in, you know, the rooms you end up in and who you're sharing the rooms with. And that's really true with marriage. And it's good to find, you know, I also have found a wife that there's nothing I'd rather do than be in a room with her. That's another reason we're not like not clamoring to go to Porkfest. It's like, well, we could spend $2,500 and take time. She could take time off work, and we could go get in a car and drive to Denver and fly to so-and-so and get someone to house it and feed the cats and go do this stuff and be with our friend. But you know what? It's important that we went there once to meet all these people that we, you know, are friends with on the internet and do radio with. But I don't really have that much of a need to meet them repeatedly every year. Nothing against them. It's more against, like, you know, to me, the idea of the sharing of ideas and the creation of art or, you know, product or media going forth on a daily basis is more important than being in the same room with people. And that can be done, you know, remotely right now. So yeah, man, find people you want to be in the same room with, even if you're not in the same room with them.
I think one of the major things we learned in 2012 too, my wife and I, that is, that we learned is that, you know, life is so brief. And this is kind of a cliche, and people say this all the time, but 2012 really hammered it home to us that people that appear in every way healthy and happy, bam, they can be gone. Just in the wink of an eye, they can be gone for no reason or for every reason. And we have no control over these things. It's not like, you know, you spend your whole life controlling your diet and making sure you exercise and checking your weight and making sure you're fit and doing all this stuff. Bill Buford is an example of this. Here's a guy who had just stellar health for years and years and years. And then, bam, out of nowhere, it turns out he's got a heart problem that almost killed him.
Right around the same time that you had a heart event, too. And it's like, yeah, if you looked at a picture of you and him next to each other, and I'm not insulting you at all, you were basically just saying this. And, you know, you said, who's going to have a heart attack the next 5 years? Everybody would pick you.
Right.
Yeah, but you both did. And he's, yeah, man. It's a lot of it is genetic, too. A lot of it's like the roll of the dice that you don't have any control over.
Yeah, you said roll of the dice. I was going to say a big spin of a wheel, you know, click, 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 heart.
Yeah.
Click, 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 long life. You know, you just don't know.
Yeah.
But you have to realize that you know, it can be a bus. It can be some idiot that's texting and wanders into your lane. It can be anything, and it can happen. I was in sitting on the border of Reno and Sparks, Nevada, sitting at a red light, going on my way to go collect a bill for work that I had done for a chiropractor at his house. I installed a computer network, and I built a back porch that was the diversity of the company that I owned at the time. And so I'm sitting there thinking about this bill and thinking about how I'm going to present it to this guy, because it's going to be about twice as much as he expected. But it was, you know, catering to his different varying needs as we went through. And out of the clear blue sky, literally, a guy coming the opposite direction runs the red light that I was sitting at about 65 miles an hour in a 35 zone, hits a car, goes airborne, lands literally on top of my head with a big four-wheel drive pickup, and came just a hair's width of killing me. And it was literally out of the clear blue sky that this happened. They had to bring the jaws of life and dig me out of this thing and everything. I still didn't learn the life lesson that I learned in 2012. This accident took place in 1995. But still, the point is there that you can just be living your life thinking everything's fine, and just out of nowhere, an event happens, and you never get a chance to back up and change things and realign things and talk to those people who are really important in your life. It's all gone. And you don't have any control over it at all. And that's life. I mean, in the olden days, it could have just as easily been, I'm standing there, you know, scratching my ear, and bam, a lion's got me, and I can't do a thing about it. You know, yeah. That's the human existence.
It could still be that way here, man. People die. People get eaten by bears every couple of years at Yellowstone, but they're usually being stupid and trying to feed Doritos to the bears when they're told not to and have their picture taken or something. But yeah. All right, we'll be back with more life lessons from losers. No, I'm kidding. Winners who learned how not to lose. There you go. Winners who are winners because they should have lost with what they were doing before.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Having outgrown childish libertarian fantasies, I now believe in worms! What is Libertarians Against Humanity? It's the only unofficial Cards Against Humanity expansion pack by libertarians, for libertarians, and against libertarians. Libertarians Against Humanity is free to play online, or join the Indiegogo campaign to get physical copies and other perks to play with friends or status you haven't defued yet. Because if we don't laugh, the status win.
Not recommended for faint heart, thin skins, or those who easily rustle jimmies. Consult a physician if you experience common blood pressure or laughter lasts longer than 4 hours.
That's libertariansagainsthumanity.com.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Freedom Fiends. So, Ben.
Michael.
You know what I was doing 20 years ago, Christmas Eve, this past week?
Wow. Tell me about it.
I just remembered this because I was thinking about people having vows of poverty. I spent Christmas Eve 20 years ago in 1994 not hanging out with family, not going to any party, not eating really well. I spent the night on Polk Street in San Francisco with a Catholic priest bringing food, clean needles, and midnight mass to homeless drug addicts.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that like, I'm great. It's more like I was just recently sober off a heroin habit that I kicked in July of 1994. And pretty much nobody, I still wasn't like that really back to somebody that most people would want to spend Christmas with.
Wow.
And, you know, he was, this guy was a controversial Catholic priest, because he, you know, he gave clean needles to drug addicts and bleach and condoms. And, you know, a lot of people are like, that's got nothing to do with the Lord, and that's liberalism gone amok. But first of all, he didn't ask for government handouts to do this. It was private charity. It was a private, you know, like three-person Catholic charity that paid for this. And he went out and did it. And people went with him and brought, you know, they would get emergency blankets in bulk, you know, because when you're a drug addict and you're homeless, every day is an emergency. So it's kind of fitting that we'd bring him emergency blankets. And, you know, he'd just make some soup, you know, like a big, like, you know, 20-gallon carafe of soup, and get, you know, condoms and needles and bring them and give them to homeless people and say, you know, homeless drug addicts, and say, you know, if you want to have mass, I'll be having mass. And he would literally set up with a little card table in an alley, in where the alley fed to a street on Polk Street, and do a mass, do a midnight mass, you know, every weekend, but especially, you know, on Christmas. And some of the drug addicts would come do it. And here's the thing, like, people who say, you know, like, I've been watching this show called West Wing. Do you know that show? It's about,
yeah,
it's by Sorkin, Aaron Sorkin, who's a writer I really like, but it's his most like I watch cop shows because they have good writings usually, but I'm like, I have to have suspension of statism because the cops are all doing bad things in them. But this makes cop shows look libertarian, because it's about the president and it's a Democratic president. And I just have to like grit my teeth to go, this is just a good office comedy. It happens to be the Oval Office, but you know, it's a good office. It's good writing and I watch it, but it's so like praiseful of the, not just of the president or of the Democrats, but of government. Like the guy who writes this, Aaron Sorkin, like really believes that government can fix all the ills of mankind.
Ugh.
To the point where like one of the reviews of it said, like, who are these morally pure characters in this show? And what rock did they crawl out from under? You know, like people like that don't exist. Whereas it's kind of making me really itching for the next season of House of Cards, which is, you know, a lot more accurate. It's about congressmen who like literally murder people with their bare hands to get things done, which is, you know, how they are, even if they're not doing it with their own bare hands. But yeah, so there's a thing in there of like, you know, the Democrats are trying to legalize and fund needle exchange in the inner cities. And the Republicans are like, no, and blocking it. It's a big wedge issue. And here's the thing. It's like, it shouldn't be government funded, but it shouldn't be illegal. I'm here to say that literally if needle exchange were illegal when I was living in San Francisco, I would be dead and you'd be listening to someone else on the radio right now. So if you like hearing anything we say, or even just find us amusing to laugh at, it's because of needle exchange, because of private needle exchange in San Francisco, that I am not dead from back when I was a junkie 20 years ago. So yeah, I would go help this priest. You know, he would minister to, you know, it's Jesus ate with the sinners. Jesus broke bread with the sinners and the prostitutes and the ne'er-do-wells. And so, you know, why shouldn't a priest go do it? That's what I think.
You know, and that was one of the criticisms. This group of rabbis actually approached Jesus and said, you know, look at yourself, dude, look at yourself. You hang out with the disgusting, the dregs of society. You're hanging out with prostitutes, with alcoholics, with wine bibbers, they called them. And you're hanging out with tax collectors of all the disgusting human beings on the face of the planet. You're hanging out with tax collectors. And they said, how do you justify yourself as a rabbi? How do you justify doing this? And Jesus looked at him and said, look, it's not the healthy that need the hospital.
Yep. Worms.
Worms.
We'll be back on the Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Hey, this is Squisscar Squiggles from Death Clocks, and you're listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get State Speech is Hate Speech, Guns and Weed, Buy Sheep for Sheep on Sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Freedom Fiends.
All right, so Ben Stone, Bad Quaker, I was telling a story about 20 years ago, Christmas Eve, hanging out with the wine bibbers and the prostitutes and helping a priest minister to them and give them soup, blankets, clean needles, condoms, and little bottles of bleach for cleaning their needles. So, yeah, it's because of stuff like that that I'm alive. So I wanted to just put it out there. You don't need the government to fund that kind of stuff. There's enough people that there's a lot of people who are recovering addicts who have good jobs now and are productive members of society, as people like to say, who are happy to give money to programs like that because things like that save their life. They're happy to give back. You don't need the government for that. You just need, like most things in life, you just need the government to get out of the way. There should not be any law about that. And, you know, you don't have to do it downtown in front of the nice department stores. You can take it over to Skid Row. That's where people are anyway because of the government who are, you know, afflicted with that kind of illness. But here's something kind of cool about that priest was that he told me that he had a vow of poverty. And I hung out with him a bunch. I didn't just do this that one Christmas Eve. I did it, you know, probably every weekend or every other weekend for a few months. I would go spend a few hours helping him do his midnight mass and soup kitchen on the street out of a van. And the thing was, he said he had a vow of poverty, but like, you know, I'd been to his house, I'd been to his office, I'd driven around in his van. It was like, he had a nice van. He had a simple apartment, but he had like, you know, tape recorders and, you know, a little mimeograph machine and, you know, some two-way radios and he had equipment, you know, and I was like, well, how can you say, you know, I pictured a vow of poverty, like, and he had a bed, you know, he wasn't sleeping on a rock on the floor. And I was like, how is this a vow of poverty? You have a bunch of stuff. And he's like, look around. All the stuff I have is tools for doing my ministry. And I thought about it and I was like, yeah, man, he doesn't have any luxuries. He doesn't have, you know, anything that's, you know, just for him. It's all for the ministry. I mean, he had, you know, five or six sets of clothing too, like, you know, but they weren't fancy. And I've kind of emulated that. Like, I'm in a room full of, you know, a few thousand dollars worth of audio equipment and video equipment, but it's all stuff that I use to, you know, produce and disseminate radio and podcasts and teach other people to do it. Also, I spend about $100 a year on clothing and probably $1,000 a year or more on equipment. And I generally give my old equipment away to other people when I upgrade. You know, I don't stockpile it or sell it. I give it to other people I know that are interested in doing this kind of liberty media. So I'm not quite as vow of poverty as that guy, but pretty much most of my expenditures and priorities are for media production and helping other people get better at media production. So talk a little bit about that, Ben, with how you have structured your life.
Yeah, I actually have two thoughts that I want to be sure and cover. One is I want to give an avenue. If somebody's saying, yeah, well, what do I do? Well, here's an avenue. You can go to Bitcoin, Not Bombs. And our friend David Barker runs that site, and he helps people all the time. I mean, that's one of the things he does. There's a charity that he runs, and he gets food into the homeless.
He feeds homeless people in the same neighborhoods that I was helping this priest in. He doesn't do needle exchange, but you know, he goes out and feeds people and gives them blankets and gives them hope, man. And you know, that's not giving a hand out, that's giving a hand up. It really is, the way that if you do it right.
And unlike government aid or government help or whatever you want to call it, you know, Davi is not robbing productive workers someplace else. He's not putting a gun to anyone's head and forcing them to pay for his favorite charity. He is providing a service. He's providing goods and a service, and then he's taking a part of that and doing good things with it.
He's also helping other charities learn how to use Bitcoin so they don't have to deal with, you know, government money trips and traps and loops and hoops.
Yeah, our other friend MK Lords over here in Pensacola, Florida, is doing a very similar thing with the homeless outreach there. I hope before we leave this region, I hope to get over there and go through that area and kind of look at some of the work that's being done over there. But it's really important stuff, and it's stuff that you can do even without, you know, going out and getting dirty or whatever. You can be a part of that kind of thing without being robbed by the government. And using Bitcoin is a really cool way to do it because it completely eliminates the government from the whole loop. So they're not taking their cut. They're not, you know, moistening their beak, so to speak.
Wetting their beak. What's that from? That's a mafioso who said that, wasn't it?
Yeah. The first time I heard it was, I think, the second what was that series of movies about the mafia?
The Untouchables, the Regulators, the
Mario Puzo's The Godfather.
Yeah.
I think it was in the second one of those there was a reference to the Godfather moistening his beak. He didn't want everything. He just wants to moisten his beak. And, you know, I want to go back to, before I go off on a tangent about mafia and government, I wanted to hit this other thing too. You know, it is important to realize that Jesus did do that. If you believe any of the story of Jesus, which I do, I'm a Christian, then you have to realize that he didn't go into the ministry and get up there in the halls of the priesthood at the temple, and he didn't, you know, adorn himself in the garbs and everything. And this is one of my problems with Christianity in America today. When I was really struggling with a very young family in the early 1980s, I wanted to do the right thing. So I, you know, wanted to bring my kids into a church and let them experience Christianity and experience some of the things that I had been taught as a child. And so I started looking around at churches. This was in Ridgecrest, California, which on Sundays, that's part of our broadcast area. But anyway, you know, I started looking at different churches, and I started looking at the leadership of those churches, and I started looking at the rank and file of the congregation of those churches, and I started noticing a trend that the leadership of the churches were driving around in brand new Cadillacs and brand new Lincolns and brand new, you know, Mercedes and that kind of thing. Well, the cars out in the parking lot of those churches were like, you know, 78 Datsun, or, you know, they were all working class cars for working class people that either worked on the local military base, or they worked on the local chemical plant that was near there, or they worked in the support industries that you know, food industry or automotive support, or all the different things that make up a small town like Ridgecrest is. And I looked at the contrast and I thought, it is not right. And I've used this phrase with you before, Michael. You know, the Bible says, muzzle not the ox that treadeth out the corns. And the context of that is, in the olden days, they would gather their wheat or gather their barley or whatever, and they would put it in piles, and they would get an oxen, and they would yoke that oxen to a central pole and walk him around and around in circles. And as he walked, he would crush the wheat, and it would separate the grains from the stalks, and then therefore they could go in, and the people would take baskets, and they would throw the residue in the air and let the wind take away, you know, the small pieces, and they could separate the actual grain from the rest of the stalks, from the straw, and this kind of thing. But the ox doing this work was critical to the process. And so the Bible instructed the Israeli people not to muzzle the ox, so that if he's walking around working all day in the hot sun, crushing this barley for you or this wheat or whatever, and he wants to stop and take a bite, let him. And so the analogy there is that if a minister is working day and night, he's going to the hospital to visit the sick, and he's, you know, he's spending time at the church and doing things, and he's going out and helping the poor, and he's doing all these things, then he should be able to have enough to live comfortably, like the priest that you were talking about. But what we see so often in Christianity is the minister is driving that Cadillac, or the minister is driving that brand new Mercedes or Lincoln, and the rank and file of his congregation are struggling week to week. And yet he's putting on them every week. He's telling them, we need your tithe, or we need your offerings, or the children in Africa are starving, or whatever. Well, you know, well, he eats the fat of the lamb. Well, he indulges beyond a proportion of what his congregation. And that's one of the things with Christianity, I think, that stands out to so many detractors, so many people who see Christianity as hypocrisy. That's one of the main things that they see, is they see this uppity guy who won't have anything to do with anyone below him, and he's driving around in a fancy car, or he's on TV, you know, way over made up with his almost cartoonish wife that's got way too much makeup on. This is the kind of stereotype things that people think of when they think of Christianity in America. And it's really sad, because that's not the image that Jesus portrayed. What Jesus did was a whole lot more like what that priest was doing in San Francisco. And that has nothing to do with building your own ego, and it has nothing to do with filling your own bank account or having a giant screen TV while, you know, while the people in your congregation are struggling with payments week to week just to get by, or, you know, worrying about whether or not they're going to have gas money to drive back and forth to work. It's really a contrast there that is a black eye on Christianity in America, I think.
Well spoken.
And it's not just grumpy old men whining on the radio about the way things ought to be. I mean, this is really clear. It's the way humans ought to treat each other. We shouldn't depend on the government robbing our neighbor to pay and help the poor people. That's not right. That's wrong. Yeah. We shouldn't depend on the government robbing our neighbors to support us. That's not right either.
Yeah, a lot of churches confuse those two. There's a lot of like social justice polluting spirituality these days, not just Christian churches, but, you know, a lot of religious organizations in America and elsewhere. You know, you have the preacher up, the scholar up, the leader up at front, giving a speech and talking about, you know, the teachings of Jesus of charity, and then making a little twist in the language to make it sound like letting the government rob people at gunpoint and increasing taxes to be quote unquote charitable is acting like Jesus, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, that would really be an insult to Jesus.
I mean, yeah, he kicked over the money changers' tables. He was not, and that was kind of a proto government thing too. But yeah, man, he wasn't down with the theft of the state.
One of our favorite internet memes is who would Jesus drone?
Nobody.
Nobody, but he might kick over some tables.
Yeah. We'll be back for the redemption in the third act of the Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space. Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Freedom Fiends. Redemption in the third act. And Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, is going to deliver the final chapter of this sermon. Go, Ben, go, Ben, go, Ben, go.
Yeah, so we're talking about do everything as if it's the only thing you'll be remembered for. And we talked about a few things over the course of the show today. And if you didn't, if you're in an area where you only hear the second half, the second hour of the show, be sure and get over to don't go to badquaker.com. Go to Freedom Fiends. That's Freedom FEENS.com. And you can always download this show or you can download previous shows. But if you only heard the second hour of this, be sure and hear the first hour because they really connect together. We were talking about, you know, building things that are going to last and things that people are going to remember you for, and then make your efforts actually matter and decide who you're spending time with, who is stealing your time and who you're giving your time to and what you're giving your time. You know, life is so brief. It's just a wink. It's a blink in the night. And to take that small amount of time that we have and make sure that that investment is worthwhile, a life worth living. And in doing that, you know, there's so many critical aspects that we don't want to waste that time on things that are unproductive or just wasting your time or spending your time feeding other people that are just leeches and they're just going to suck that time away from you. And when you stop giving it to them, they'll go and just suck that life off of somebody else. Be selective and be, you know, very discriminative with who you're around and who you give your time to and what causes you work with. And yet, at the same time, we talked about charity and how important charity is to really have a life where you feel like you have given something back. And we talked about Bitcoin Not Bombs and some of the stuff that MK Lords is doing down there in Pensacola, where you can actually get involved without walking in and handing the homeless a sandwich or without putting a sweater on a homeless person or doing whatever it takes. You can work through organizations like Bitcoin Not Bombs and do that stuff without the government's influence. And we also talked about how important it is to understand the distinguishing characteristics of robbery, where someone under the guise of saying, oh, we're doing good, this is charity, that's why we're robbing you to go and provide needles to the poor, provide food to the poor, or health care to the poor. But if they're robbing you to do it, then it's not charity. Charity begins in a decision of your own making, when you decide that you want to help someone. And the reward of charity is that you weren't forced to do it. There's no reward in knowing that, hey, you know, I was robbed by taxes to take this money and go give it to the children in Africa or give it to the, you know, the starving people in India or the starving people in Atlanta or the starving people in Detroit or whatever. No, there's no reward in that. The reward comes in knowing that you voluntarily did something that you didn't have to do. And that's really, you know, we kick around the word hero all the time in America. The cop's a hero, the firefighter's a hero, the teacher's the hero. But really, that's not what a hero is. A hero is a person who does something that they didn't have to do, and they do it without seeking a reward for doing it. And that's really where heroism starts. It's not in, you know, going out there and beating somebody in the head because they're not obeying your command. That's not heroism. It's not going out and invading another country. That's not heroism either. Heroism comes when you look at something that needs to be done and you do it whether you're going to be rewarded or not. And Michael talked about, you know, this priest that he worked with in San Francisco that went down and took his time and actually made an influence and a difference on people's lives.
And saved lives. Saved lives, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And how much similar to what Jesus did, That's exactly what Jesus did. Jesus didn't, you know, Jesus didn't go and petition the Roman government so that they would tax the Jewish people more so that they could help the poor. Jesus didn't do that. He said, well, you know, the poor are going to be with you forever.
Yep. And I want to say the name of the Bitcoin charity that MK Lords is involved with is Sean's Outpost at seansoutpost.com. That's SEANSOUTPOST.com. seansoutpost.com. They've served over 138,000 meals to homeless, all paid with Bitcoin donations. And if you want to learn more about Bitcoin, that's a good place to go. So is Bitcoin Not Bombs. And it's been a great show, Ben Stone, Bad Quaker.
Thank you, Michael.
I hope we did it as good as if it's the last thing and only thing we'll ever do or be remembered for, but I hope we get to do a lot more.
Worms.
Worms.